All right, so we're picking up our study of Judges here in chapter 7. And we see Gideon's been called to lead Israel. First, the very first thing he's commanded to do is to tear down the town's altar and an idol to Baal and Asherah, which his dad owned. They were in, you know, in property of his father. He does this, and because he takes this act, he earns the nickname Jerubbaal, which means let Baal contend with, or let Baal contend with him. Now, we're not told how much time passes in chapter 6 between verses 32 and 33, but what happens next is that a massive enemy force comes into the land, and we saw back at the beginning of the chapter 6 in verses 3 through 5 that this is a repeating cycle, that these Midianites with the Amalekites and the other eastern tribes would come in and they would ravage the land. They would decimate it. And because of that, Israel is now hiding out in caves. They've got hidden shelters where they're trying to hide from these enemy forces because they're so numerous and they're not able to fight against them. And so we see here in verse 34 of chapter 6 that the Spirit of the Lord comes on Gideon. In verse 34, and he rallies four of the tribes, and he asks God for a sign. Now, you know, and we see that in verses 36 through 40. Now, you might think, why does he need further signs? At this point, the angel of the Lord's already appeared to him. He's already directly spoken to God. And now the Holy Spirit has come on him, but he's still wanting more assurance. What more assurance could he want? And to answer that question, it is good to ask ourselves a question, and that is, are we any different? You know, when we look at our faith today, we look at what God's given us in our lives. We have 66 books. We have 66 books of history, of God's goodwill, of his showing his goodness and insight into his mind. 66 books that provide perfect clarity and assurance of what God expects from us. And not just that, not just regarding where we come from and why we're here, but also what happens after death. What an afterlife is going to be like. God's given us those answers. He's given us those assurances. But does that mean that we always obey? No, right? Sometimes we still question. Sometimes we still doubt. And it's worth kind of, you know, being mindful of this, because sometimes we just take it so for granted. You have to understand that with the Bible that we have, with the full revelation of God, these 66 books, we have more insight into God's mind, into his will, into his plans than Elijah, than Moses, than all of the judges combined ever had access to. Right? They could only see in part what we can see in full, because we can see everything laid out. We can see it all in hindsight. Over in Ephesians 3, verse 3, it says, that is the mystery made known to me by revelation, as I have already written briefly. In reading this, then you will be able to understand my insight into the mystery of Christ, which was not made known to people in other generations, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to God's holy apostles and prophets. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we taking full advantage of that? Are we spending daily time in our Bible learning about God's will and understanding God and his mindset, getting an idea of what he expects from us and why? Something to consider. In Luke 12, verse 48, it says, but the one who does not know and does things deserving punishment will be beaten with few blows. But from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. And it's important that we keep in mind that we are the people that have been given much more, right? You know, are we taking our faith more serious or less serious because it's so easily available? Because God expects more from us, given that he's given everything to us. Revelation's been fulfilled. It's been finished. There's nothing else coming that's going to be added to our Bibles. Everything that God wants us to know, he's already given to us. And that's something that the Israelites, they couldn't boast of, even having prophets in their midst. But we have that. We have that advantage. And so God does expect us to act on that. He expects us to be active, to have an active faith. And we need to make sure we're taking full advantage of everything God's given us to work with. Picking up here in chapter 7 and verse 16, it says, and dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars into the hands of all of them with torches inside. Watch me, he told them, follow my lead. And when I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. And when I and all who are with me blow our trumpets from all around the camp, blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. And Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guard. They blew the trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars, grasping the torches in their left hand and holding in their right hands the trumpets that were to blow. They shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." And while each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. And when the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to Beth Shitta toward Zahara, as far as the border of Abel Mahola toward Tabath. And Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh were called out, and they pursued the Midianites. And Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize the waters of the Jordan ahead of them as far as Bethbara." And so all the men of Ephraim who were called out, and they seized the waters of the Jordan as far as Bethbara, and they also captured two of the Midianite leaders, Oreb and Zeeb. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb and Zeeb at the winepress of Zeeb. And they pursued the Midianites and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon, who was by the Jordan. Now, if you recall back to last week's class, when in the setup of this, that this massive army had came down and encamped, and Gideon initially started off with a large grouping. He had 33,000 people with him. And the Lord said at the beginning of this chapter, "That's too many people. I don't want you to go into battle with that many people because I don't want you taking credit for this victory." So he whittles it down. He has all the people that were fearful or scared to leave. And he's got 10,000 left after that. And God still says, "That's too many." And so he divides them further by the way they drink water. An arbitrary thing to do, but it worked because the whole point was God wanted to whittle it down to just a handful of people. And so Gideon here, he is left with just 300 soldiers to take on hundreds of thousands of enemies. And so he comes down here and they shout and they light the torches and they sound the trumpets. And the people that are camped, the watch here that's mentioned, this will be the middle of the night. So this is roughly around midnight or a little bit after that. And that the people here, you see that they cry out in a panic. The trumpets that are being talked about here, these aren't trumpets like we think of them. These would be ram horns. That's what they would have considered to be trumpets. And we see that due to the combination of the darkness and people being half asleep or already sleeping, the fear that the Lord has put into them, and all the shouting, that the Midianites, they start attacking each other. They start killing each other. They can't tell who's their friend and who's their enemy. They're basically just driven into chaos. And in their panic, they start to flee. Gideon doesn't want them to escape, and that's understandable. He doesn't want to see this cycle keep repeating, so he wants to really drive the point home and pursue these people while they're terrified and while they're on the run. He sends messages to Naphtali, to Asher, and to Manasseh to help give chase. We see that in verses 23 and 24 here. Those called in the hunt here might have been some of the same people that were just dismissed not too long ago. Now, there's a lot of speculation on these verses and how to interpret this, because nowhere in Scripture does it actually say that God wanted Gideon to summon more soldiers in at this moment. He calls out to the people of these four tribes that he had already gathered troops from among. He also sends messengers to Ephraim here to help pursue these leaders. And so there are some that will say, well, this is Gideon going beyond what the Lord intended. And others will say, well, this was God's plan all along. God's plan all along was for them to take the field, and that at this point it would have been okay for Gideon to do this. But Gideon's remarks throughout this exchange, they're not very flattering for Gideon. They're not helpful to his cause if you want to take the stance that Gideon had a righteous mind in doing this. If you look at some of the things he says, "Watch me, follow my lead. Shout out for the Lord and for Gideon." You get the sense, the very real sense, that he is putting way too much emphasis on him in this conflict. And so that's something to think about. You know, he's not depending on God. He's depending on others. He's depending on rallying people to his cause. Regardless of Gideon's intention here, victory is the Lord's. And God made this abundantly clear throughout chapter 7. In verses 2 and verses 7 and verses 9, God makes it clear that he was the one that was going to make the victory, that he was going to save Gideon. This wasn't going to be done by anything Gideon was going to do. Great numbers and impossible feats, they don't mean anything to God. When you're talking about what God's capable of, There are no obstacles that are too great for the Lord to overcome. We saw this back in the time of humanity during Noah's day in the flood, when really the whole world outside of Noah and his family were just totally wicked. We saw this with the Tower of Babel, okay, with the empire they were trying to build. We saw this with the Egyptian army pursuing Israel at the Red Sea. We saw this with Jericho. We saw this with the five armies of the Amorites. And so it is too with Satan and with death. There's nothing that God can't beat. There's nothing that God can't claim victory with. And anyone that's going to oppose God is going to suffer. They're going to lose that fight. They can't win. Yeah.
Just jumping pretty far ahead, but in chapter 8, verse 7, it does seem like he's really got his blood up at this point. But he also gives credit. He knows that God is going to give him victory in the future, in the short term, in the near term, rather. And he says, Gideon said, "All right, when the Lord has given Zebna and Zalmunna into my hand, said I will trash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and the briars." So there he is giving credit to God that, you know, if we're successful, it's because God has granted us success.
That's right. And with Gideon, Gideon's a really great example for us to study because there's a lot of us in him, right? He's a flawed hero. He's not perfect, and he doesn't do everything the right way. And we're going to see that throughout the rest of the account with him. He has some really great victories, but there's also some things where he really drops the ball with. And there's a picture here in this victory, in this battle, there's a picture here that we can look at as far as pertaining to Judgment Day. When the trumpet sounds, the enemies of God are going to be plunged into chaos, confusion, and fear. Just like how the Midianites were here. They're going to be brought to their knees and utterly destroyed. There is no prevailing against God. Over in Isaiah chapter 45 and starting in verse 23, it says, "By myself I have sworn, my mouth has uttered in all integrity a word that will not be revoked. Before me every knee will bow, by me every tongue will swear. They will say to me, in the Lord alone are deliverance and strength. All who have raged against him will come to him and be put to shame. But all of the descendants of Israel will find deliverance in the Lord and will make their boast in him." Now, something for us to consider. Who are the descendants of Israel?
The Jews were, but now we are.
Now we are, right? Some people will use that verse that I just quoted there to claim that, you know, all Israelites go to heaven, or they get a pass because they're his chosen people. But Galatians 3:29 says, "If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise." And of just a few verses before that, in verse 27, it says, "For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourself with Christ." So the descendants of Israel are Christians. It's people that have been baptized. That you're in Christ if you're baptized. That's the way that works. And so it's important that, you know, we be mindful of that we are the descendants of Israel. We're the descendants of Abraham because we're heirs of the promise that was made to Abraham. And we get in there by Christ, by being baptized. Yeah.
Go back to the guy who had the dream. He was going down. One thing the guy does reveal in his dream is it was the sword of Gideon that's going to deliver himself. I think when he's calling the sword of Gideon, he does put the Lord first, at least. You know,
that's
he
true.
Does, but to say the sword of Gideon, he's only repeating what God had already said.
That's true. Well, what the Midianite was claiming.
His arrogance. I think he's just repeating what was revealed to him in this other guy's dream. He overheard the dream.
You might be right about that. That is true. That could totally be another way to look at this. But we're going to see a trend with Gideon to step outside the bounds and to put himself into situations he ought not be. But you might be right about it. And in that instance, that might be it.
It takes a lot to go up against hundreds of thousands or just 300. It takes a lot of faith.
That's true.
A lot of people, unfortunately, power can go to your head. And there are things that all of us, we can have our moments and turn back, but it takes a lot of faith for him to do what he's
done. It does. And he is mentioned in Hebrews in the Hall of Faith. So that's important to remember. In chapter 8 here, starting in verse 1, it says, "And now the Ephraimites asked Gideon, 'Why have you treated us like this? Why didn't you call us when you went to fight Midian?' And they challenged him vigorously. But he answered them, 'What have I accomplished compared to you? Aren't the gleanings of Ephraim's grapes better than the full grape harvest of Abiezer? God gave Oreb and Zeeb, the Midianite leaders, into your hands. What was I able to do compared to you?' And at this, their resentment against him subsided. Now, it's important to remember that in the ancient world, war wasn't looked at in a bad way. It was a way to enrich yourself. It was a way to get more riches. It was a way to take land, to take flocks, to build reputation. So a lot of people really looked forward to war. It was really a way to improve your station in a way that you otherwise couldn't, okay? And we see that the Ephraimites here, they're angered because they weren't invited to take part in the fighting before this point, before they were called down to help track down these leaders. But one thing that's important to note here is that it shows us a glimpse into the carnal mindedness of Israel. We see here that even in victory, they're divided. They're arguing and quibbling over spoils. It's not about just a victory for the Lord. It's not just about freeing Israel from this oppression. They want money. They want riches. They want to increase their station. If their minds were focused on serving God and not enriching themselves, then this really shouldn't have been an issue. But it becomes an issue, and Gideon, he navigates this pretty well. This is a decent way to navigate it. He kind of, again, it's kind of almost like a very good politician's answer. He's like, hey, what are we? We're nothing. You guys took out the leader, right? He's giving them the glory and trying to, settle that storm and keep it from blowing out of proportion. And sometimes, we as Christians, we bicker and complain a lot. Sometimes we can get angry and upset over silly, petty things, can't we? Right? And we're no different. Sometimes we get angry and frustrated with our spouses over the littlest things, things that are just silly to even repeat. And that's true also within the church. Sometimes we bump heads, or sometimes we kind of nitpick with each other because we see each other week after week. We build relationships with each other. And that means sometimes we don't see the most flattering side of each other either. But it's important to know that we need to focus on God and love for one another. We need to focus on our mission, not necessarily all the faults and the things we could have done better with each other. It's important that we keep the love of that we're supposed to have for each other fresh on our minds, and we focus on God more and ourselves less. Focus on being more forgiving and being more patient with one another and on higher things. If we do that, we're going to have a better time in the kingdom as well as just in our personal lives here. And there's also something else here. This account with the Ephraimites, it kind of reminds me of the account with Deborah and Barak back in chapter 4, verses 9. If you remember Barak, when Deborah summoned him and told him he was going to go to war, what was his response to that? He wanted her to go with him, right? He didn't want to do it. He said, look, I'm only going to do this if you're going to come with me, right? Back in chapter 4 here, in verse 9, and Deborah's response to that was, certainly I will go with you, said Deborah, but because of the course you are taking, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. And I think it's worth noting, I have no doubt in my mind, had Gideon not asked for the Ephraimites' help, that he would have been the one that took out these leaders. How do I know that?
Well, God was willing.
God was going to deliver the victory either way, right? It was his decision to get another tribe involved in this, right? So, had he just stayed the course and not tried to reach out to other people for help and just trusted in the Lord and not on other men, I have no doubt victory still would have been his. He still would have been able to get his hands on these leaders. And then he wouldn't have had to even navigate this little storm here. But he does. He navigates it. In verses 4 here, it says, and Gideon and his 300 men exhausted, yet keeping up the pursuit, came to the Jordan and crossed it. And he said to the men of Succoth, give my troops some bread. They are worn out, and I am still pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. But the officials of Succoth said, do you already have the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna in your possession? Why should we give bread to your troops? Then Gideon replied, just for that, when the Lord has given Zebra and Zalmunna into my hand, I will tear your flesh with desert thorns and briars. And from there he went up to Peniel and made the same request of them, but they answered to the men of, as the men of Succoth had. So he had said to the men of Peniel, when I return in triumph, I will tear down this tower. Now Zebra and Zalmunna were in Kakor with a force of about 15,000 men, all that were left of the armies of the eastern peoples. 120,000 swordsmen had fallen. And Gideon went up by the routes of the nomads east of Noba and Jogbeah and attacked the unsuspecting army. And Zeba and Zalmunna, the two kings of Midian, fled. But he pursued them and captured them, routing their entire army. And Gideon, son of Joash, then returned from the battle by the pass of Heres, and he caught up to a young man of Succoth and questioned him. And the young man wrote down for him the names of the 77 officials of Succoth and the elders of the town. And then Gideon came and said to the men of Succoth, "Here are Zebra and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, 'Do you already have the hands of Zebra and Zalmunna in your possession? Why should we give bread to your exhausted men?'" And he took the elders of the town and taught the men of Succoth a lesson by punishing them with desert thorns and briars. And he also pulled down the tower of Peniel and killed the men of the tower. So there's a couple lessons we can take away from this. Number one, we need to keep up the fight. We need to not be discouraged. We need to make sure that we don't lose sight of our mission, our end goal, right? Over in 2 Timothy 4:7, it says, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith." That's the mentality that we all want to have on our deathbeds, right? That we didn't give up, that we didn't surrender to the pressures of this world, that we kept heart and we trusted in God. And that's important, because there's always going to be haters. There's always going to be naysayers. There's always going to be people that are going to try to get you down and keep you from being productive for the Lord. And you can't let them get to you. You can't let that stop you from doing what you know you need to do. You need to surround yourselves in life with people of like mind, with similar faith. Okay? You need to people who are strong and courageous and who put God first. And that's really important. There's a Proverbs that I really love. It Proverbs 27:17 says, "As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another." And that's so true. That is so true. You need to surround yourselves with spiritual winners. You need to surround yourself with people that, you know, that have their hearts and minds focused on God. Because if those are the people you surround yourself with, you're going to be like those people too. If you surround yourself with people that doubt or are always naysaying or always negative, they're going to bring you down. Even if it takes a while, eventually it's going to rub off on you. And you don't want to let that happen. Something else we see here, Gideon here, he displays a rather vengeful and proud attitude. Not that it's wrong for him to want to punish people that wouldn't offer aid. I get the importance of that to an extent. He's on a mission that's God sent, and these people are refusing to help. So there's definitely guilt and blame to go all around. But the idea of all right, when I come back, I'm going to torture you. Or when I come back, I'm going to tear down your tower. There's a vengefulness coming up here that he's not going to tolerate. A proudness in his attitude that he wants to show them. And I don't see Gideon in this moment acting righteously so much as I see him on a mission to get the job done. And he's going to punish anyone that's going to stand against him. There's a difference. There's a difference between doing the Lord's will and doing what he has called us to do, and then having a bad attitude or a bad heart about it, or holding grudges against people that we ought not have. It's not a perfect parallel, because we don't live in his time, and it was a different world back then. But we got to make sure that we don't let our hearts be consumed with hatred. We don't let our hearts get consumed with grudges or with, "I'll show them." That's the wrong attitude for a Christian to have. That's not what God or Jesus has called us to do. That wasn't the attitude Jesus ever had. Yeah.
Yeah, and I agree with you, but you also we have to put ourselves as much as we can back in his situation. He's in a war, really. I mean, not a figurative war, an actual war, and these people won't help him. And these are his countrymen that should have. You know, he's out there fighting for them, and they won't even give him bread.
I agree.
And so...
But you know what we don't...
Did he act appropriately? Maybe not, but they committed an offense too.
They did. Okay. Yeah, their actions are not good either. But you know what I don't see Gideon do? I don't see Gideon pray to God for nourishment. I don't see Gideon consulting God with, "My people are famished, but we want to keep pursuing. Give me something, God." I don't see that. I see him turning to his left and turning to his right and asking unrighteous people for aid rather than looking to the Lord for deliverance. Again, you know, there's several ways you can look at that. But if his heart was set on God and just looking straight at the Lord the whole way through this, I think God would have provided nourishment if they needed it. And clearly, they still got the job done without it. So there's something there. In verses 18 here, picking up, it says, "And then he asked Zeba and Zalmunna, 'What kind of men did you kill at Tabor?' 'Men like you,' they answered, 'each one with the bearing of a prince.' And Gideon replied, 'Those were my brothers, the sons of my own mother. As surely as the Lord lives, if you had spared their lives, I would not kill you.' And turning to Jether, his oldest son, he said, 'Kill them.' But Jether did not draw his sword because he was only a boy and was afraid. And Zeba and Zalmunna said, 'Come, but do it yourself. As is the man, so is his strength.' So Gideon stepped forward and killed them and took the ornaments off their camels' necks." So Gideon here tells these rulers, had you spared my countrymen, had you spared my family, my relatives, if you had spared people in Israel, I would have let you live. Now, what did God tell Gideon to do? Do you remember? Let's turn back to chapter 6, verse 16. It says, "The Lord answered, 'I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive.'" Did Gideon have the right to spare their lives regardless of how these leaders acted? Nope. He was to put them to death by the Lord's command. So Gideon shouldn't even have said this, because there wasn't a condition that they could have survived. Because if he was going to follow what the Lord said, every one of them had to be killed. So it didn't matter if these Midianite kings actually spared his family or spared his relatives. He was told to put him to death. And so even the act of him doing this, it's almost like he's making it himself to be the arbiter of this situation when he's not. It's God's decision. It's God's decision who's going to live and who's going to die. It wasn't Gideon's place to spare them or not. That's something I see here when I look at that. And then he tries to have his young son kill these guys in like a public execution. Now, here's the thing. It's not necessarily wrong for there to be a public execution and even a young person to do the killing in it. These were different times and they had different customs, and that's fine. We can't look at things through the lens of 2022 in the ancient world. However, to me, this displays poor judgment as a father and a leader. And the reason why I say that is if you've ever done management, if you've ever been a leader of a business or you've ever had employees, you understand that it's incumbent on a leader or a manager to know the strengths and weaknesses of his people, of his employees, to not ask of them things that they're not able to accomplish, to not demand so much. And that's especially true with us parents. You know, if as parents, especially fathers, if we put too much too soon on our children, it can break them. It can create a sense of doubt and unworthiness that will dwell in their hearts long after we're gone. So we got to be careful that we don't push our sons and daughters too hard, too fast. There's a balance to be had in what we ask our children and when we ask it. And what I see here is I see him asking a young boy to do a man's job, and the boy's not up. He's clearly not up to it. He's too scared to even draw his own sword. But in this moment, Gideon's more focused on his legacy, on his reputation, on showing that him and his sons can enact justice or vengeance rather than what's best for his son. That's my takeaway when I see this and the reaction that the young boy has. And we got to be careful that we don't pressure our kids too much. We want our children to do good, but if we're too hard on them in an unfair way, we ask too much of them, we can drive a wedge between us and our kids, and that's not good. That's not good for our families, and it's not good for the church, because we don't want to drive our children away from God. We want to drive them closer to build bonds that grow stronger over time, not divide people away from that. All right, so keep on reading here. In 22, it says, "The Israelites said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you have saved us from the hand of Midian.' But Gideon told them, 'I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you.'" Now, initially, Gideon gives the glory to God here, and this is a really great moment for Gideon. This is one of those shining moments, and if only the account ended there, that would make this a very happy story. That would be the fairy tale ending of the story, but it's not a fairy tale. And the sad thing is that what we're reading here is a historical account of a very flawed but a great man, someone who did great things but had a lot of flaws. And that's true for people throughout history. That's true for people that founded this country. That's true for people in every part of history that's ever existed. None of us are perfect, right? Only Jesus was. So, you know, it's easy for us to maybe nitpick their lives apart to a degree. But we keep reading here and we see what's Gideon's next move, what his next reaction is. In 24, it says, and he said, I do have one request, that each one of you give me an earring from the share of your plunder. And it was the custom of the Ishmaelites to wear gold earrings. And they answered, we'll be glad to give them. So they spread out a garment, and each of them threw a ring from its plunder into it. And the weight of the gold rings he asked for came to 1,700 shekels, not counting the ornaments, the pendants, and the purple garments worn by the king of Midian, or the chains that were on the camels' necks. And Gideon made the gold into an ephod, which he placed in Ephorah, his town. And all Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. So a couple of things here. An ephod, this is like a tunic or an apron. So imagine like a golden apron. Okay, it would have been really, really fancy. This thing, this is 43 pounds of gold. So in today's numbers, this thing is worth over $1 million. This is a hugely expensive, I mean, just an amazing thing to behold. And so he makes this beautiful garment, and this becomes an idol. This becomes an idol to Gideon and his family and to the Israelites. Because what they end up doing is they end up worshiping it. They don't immediately fall back into worship of Baal. That would have been bad enough. But now they're idolizing and worshiping Gideon for what he did. They're worshiping this golden tunic that represents the victories that he had, right? Who's forgotten in this?
God.
God's ignored in this. And it's sad. In verses 28, it says, thus Midian was subdued before the Israelites and did not raise his head again. During Gideon's lifetime, the land had peace for 40 years. Jerubbaal, son of Joash, which is Gideon, he went back home to live, and he had 70 sons of his own, for he had many wives. His concubine, who lived in Shechem, also bore him a son, who he named Abimelech. And Gideon, son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abrazites. And no sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals. They set up Baal-berith as their god and did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. They also failed to show any loyalty to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in spite of all the good things that he had done for them. We see here that in the aftermath of Gideon's great deeds, that we see greed, pride, lust, these things consume him. He's kind of driven by these things. He goes on to have 70 sons. Now, it says he has many wives. We're not told how many exactly, but he's got enough to give him 70 children. And on top of that, he's also got this concubine. Later in chapter 9, she'll be referenced as a slave concubine. But she lives in Shechem. She's not even an Israelite. She's a Canaanite. So on top of the him being a womanizer and being prideful and wanting this treasure and setting himself up an idol to himself, he also is a womanizer, and he has a lot of children, and on top of that, he even takes a woman that is not even of the Israelite population. When Gideon dies, Israel goes right back to worshiping the Baals. And it just goes to show you that they don't just forsake God, they even forsake their own heroes. The people that they had just worshiped and idolized and had put on such a pedestal, as soon as they're dead, they care less. And this really shows you that it's a glimpse into Israel's heart. Unfortunately, Israel has become a very shallow people. They have no conviction. They go with whatever whatever direction the wind is blowing. And it's really sad to see a people fall into that, to not have any conviction, to not have any dedication. Especially after they had been warned so much about this. I mean, you think back to the time of Joshua and all the times Joshua told these people, like, you have to be convicted. You have to obey. You have to dedicate yourself to God. They've forgotten all of that. And now you have a people that they don't even remember their own heroes. All they care about are their own desires and their own whims. And it leads them right back into this bad cycle where nothing good's going to come out of it. It's just going to be more misery, more harm, and just, you know, more evil. keep on reading here. In chapter 9, it says, Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal, went to his mother's brothers in Shechem and said to them and to all his mother's clan, ask all the citizens of Shechem, which is better for you, to have all 70 of Jerubbaal's sons rule over you or just one man? Remember, I am your flesh and blood. And when the brothers repeated all of this to the citizens of Shechem, they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is related to us. Now, really quick, Abimelech, his name, Abimelech, it means my father is king. So that's a glimpse right there into Gideon's hubris that he named his son that. Even though he didn't take the crown when it was offered to him, he still named his kid that he was a king. Abimelech is going to be crowned the first king of Israel, or in Israel. And it's an illegitimate reign. It's an illegitimate kingship, monarchy. Because God didn't accept it, and God didn't tell him that they could do it. But he's going to be the first king in Israel by the people's doing. And it's such a sad thing that even the monarchy that will later come to be established that God will approve of, that this even happens before that, because the people are doing what they want, not what God has commanded, not what God's approved of. And Israel really wanted to make Gideon a king, not just a judge. If you look back in the last part of chapter 8, when the Israelites said to Gideon, rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you have saved us from the hands of Midian. Do you understand what's being said there in that sentence? They're asking for a monarchy, right? How judges were rulers too, but how was a judge chosen?
God
chose him, right? It didn't go father to son to grandson. That's a monarchy. That's a bloodline. That's your king until you die. Then your son gets it, and then their son. They're asking for a king, and Gideon, to his credit, he turned that down, right? But that's what these Israelites, that's what they wanted, and so this sits well with them. They want this. So Abimelech appeals to the people. He appeals to his uncles. They're going to appeal to his cousins and to his family members. Notice God's not mentioned in this. This has nothing to do with God. God's the farthest thing from any of these people's minds. He's gathering support here in these first few verses. He's plotting. He's scheming. And notice what he says. Hey, look, Gideon had all these kids, but they're not like me because I'm like one of you, right? We come from the same neighborhood. We're part of the same tribe. We're part of the same clan, right? And so you want me to be in charge, not these other guys. Yeah. Yeah.
He is.
Yes, he is. And his mother, being a concubine in Shechem, she's not even an Israelite. And so really the people he's talking to, they're not Israelites either. These would have been Canaanite remnants that were living in Shechem. There's a couple issues here. Number one is, notice there's not really an issue with the people until Abimelech makes an issue, right? He creates a problem for then him to step up and benefit from. And that's what we see wicked people do. They create a problem so they can exploit it. And we see the same thing today in society. That's the same thing. People will create problems. They will create what-if scenarios that haven't even happened yet. And then they want to solve it by being the guy who steps up that you give the power to. Yeah.
And there's no indication that any of Gideon's other sons have any desire to be rulers.
Exactly.
As all of Abimelech's idea that they're going to want to be, don't you want me instead of them?
As a matter of fact, later on in this chapter, when we get to the parable about the trees, notice all the trees with honor, none of them wanted the position, right? It was only the thorn bush, only Abimelech that actually even wanted to be king, wanted to step up with that kind of power. So there's that. Gideon's sons weren't motivated to rule. I 100% agree with that. And this is important for us to remember. We got to be careful as Christians. We want to make sure, look, there never needs to be gossip or bad-mouthing among us as a people. Right? Don't fall into that trap. We are supposed to be chosen people that act differently than the rest of this world. And let's not make the mistake of thinking of the church as so casual that we should talk bad about other members just because they do something we don't like or they have a differing opinion than us. We're brothers and sisters in Christ, and we need to act like it. Over in Titus chapter 3, verse 9, it says, but avoid foolish controversies and genealogies and arguments and quarrels about the law, because these are unprofitable and useless. Warn a divisive person once, then warn them a second time, and after that, have nothing to do with them. You may be sure that such people are warped and sinful. They are self-condemned. It's very harsh language for people that cause divisions in the church, right? We got to be careful that we don't fall into that category. Over in Ephesians 4:29, it says, "Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen." Right? Our words, our actions, they need to be building each other up, helping each other out, not tearing each other down, not diminishing each other. We got to be careful that we don't push that, because it's easy to do. Right? And any group of any size, there's going to be people with different personalities, and it's easy sometimes to bump heads, but we can't let that take away from the fact that at the end of the day, we're supposed to be a family. We're supposed to be loving and kind to each other, and treat each other accordingly. And so that's important. We're going to see, how much time do we have left?
There's a couple of
minutes. Okay. We're going to get into this next week. We're going to talk about this more in depth. But the other point here that I'd like to point out is the nepotism that's involved in this and how evil and wrong that is. We've got to be careful that we don't let that take root in the church either. Because I'll tell you what, in any local body of church, there's going to be a lot of families that are intertied with each other. There's a lot of families that have intermarried. There's families that have just grown up with each other, so they become best friends. And we've got to be careful that as Christians, we don't look at some Christians as less than others because we don't know them as well, or because they're not part of our immediate family that aren't also Christians, right? We're all in this together, and it doesn't matter who we were born to or what our last names are. That's a very important lesson, and we'll dive more into that next week when we pick up. But that's an important lesson here, because that's what we see Abimelech doing. He's trying to draw lines in the sand based on who was born to who and who's tight with who. That's not the way we need to act as Christians. It's not the way godly people should act. Even among the Israelites, they're all supposed to be a family. They're all supposed to be Abraham's descendants. And so for them to even get tied up into one greater than the other, even that's not right. Especially not right for Christians today under the new law. All right, any thoughts or comments before we leave off? All right, we'll pick up there next week. Thank you so much for your time.